Hi, I'm Francesca, a registered nutritional therapist, and you're listening to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast. Welcome. My aim is to bring you down-to-earth, conversational episodes that help you develop a deeper understanding of how your body's changing in your 40s, and most importantly, how you can support yourself throughout this wonderful transitional phase of your life. Join me for my solo episodes and also episodes with guests for fun, fresh, truthful chat on all things health and happiness in your 40s. And now onto the episode. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Empowered Perimenopause podcast with me, your host, Francesca. So on today's episode, I'm addressing another listener question, and this one is about the gallbladder, specifically how it's related to estrogen health. So for the sake of keeping this person anonymous, I'm going to call her Laura. But again, as I said last week, this person will know who she is. So Laura's question came to me via email, and I really do invite you to do the same if there's something that you'd like me to address for you, a particular answer that you need about something, anything particular that you're struggling with, or just something that you want to know more about on the show, then please do drop me an email. So my email address is francesca@francesca.com, or you can head over to my website or my Instagram account and send me a DM. All of that will be in the show notes for you anyway. So let's dive into Laura's question. So first of all, here's some background on Laura. So she's 46, and in her 20s, in her home country of Azerbaijan, she was diagnosed with chronic cholecystitis with no gallstones. So cholecystitis, and hers is chronic, is basically a long-lasting inflammation of the gallbladder. It usually causes swelling and irritation within the gallbladder. It's usually diagnosed through a combination of the health and symptom history of the patient. They do a physical examination and various scans. So that's, I'm assuming, what was the case for Laura in her 20s. This situation usually causes recurrent episodes of abdominal pain, which can be very painful, and is usually associated with gallstones. But in Laura's case, there were no gallstones, which is good news. But obviously, you know, she's still having to deal with that pain, that swelling and irritation, and it would have that risk of eventually developing into gallstones. So in her 20s, Laura was basically told at the time that her body was having difficulty producing and releasing bile, and that she should eat a low-fat diet because it will be difficult for her body to break down fat and absorb it. Now, that's usually the advice that's given with for people with gallbladder issues. She was also given some sort of medication, which would have been some kind of enzyme or bile acid medication to help support the breakdown of any fats that she did eat. But in the last 15 years, Laura's managed to control the condition through her diet. She made some healthy changes, like avoiding the so-called bad fats, like the trans fats, like margarine and, you know, I guess, ultra processed foods and things. But it also meant that she ate a very low fat diet, which isn't good. It's definitely not good for hormone production and lots of other things, a stress response, and inevitably more carbohydrates as well. So neither of those things would have been helpful long term. So it's not a helpful long term answer just to stop eating fat. So now at age 46 and in perimenopause, Laura's beginning to include more protein, more good fats, which she absolutely needs to do. But is as a result of increasing her fat, of course, she's starting to experience gallbladder discomfort again. So although she said, thankfully, this is nowhere near the pain attacks that she used to experience in her 20s. And that's probably partly to do with the sort of healthy changes that she would have made since being in her 20s is probably helping, you know, with that. I think if she's anything like me in my 20s, I had, you know, everything under the sun, and it was all exacerbated so much more by my lifestyle and my diet back then. So now living in the UK, she's struggling to get another gallbladder scan via the NHS because they'll only do it if or when, you know, she has a really bad attack, which she understandably doesn't want to wait for. She wants to check and see what's going on now. But unfortunately, you know, here in the UK and some other countries as well, it's the cure versus prevention approach. So sort of waiting until something's really bad before we'll do anything, which really isn't helpful in this case. And of course, there's various reasons why that's the case on the NHS. It's because they're under so much pressure. It's obviously the financial issue of kind of doing scans when they might not need to. But, you know, either way, it's not helpful at all in this case. And of course, Laura doesn't want to wait for a horrible attack before she is treated or seen. But she's been given the impression that the gallbladder isn't taken very seriously by the NHS unless there are gallstones present. And then, you know, the solution is usually surgical removal of the organ, which, again, she wants to avoid, and rightly so. She wants to make sure it never comes to that, and also understands that just because she doesn't have gallstones, it doesn't mean her gallbladder health is okay, particularly if she's experiencing symptoms now from increasing fats. Then she definitely knows that's a sign all is not okay. So her preventative attitude here is really great, and she wants to take control of it, you know, before anything significant ever happens, and hopefully even reverse the whole issue naturally. So that's really great that that's what Laura wants to do. So her question to me specifically is that she wants to better understand the role of the gallbladder in estrogen detoxification, so how it helps to support that process of the body getting rid of our used estrogen efficiently. And she wants to know if her history of gallbladder issues may have been contributing to her perimenopausal symptoms. I'm presuming that's because she now knows from, you know, listening to my episodes and other things, she now knows the importance of estrogen detoxification for management of many of the typical symptoms of perimenopause and period challenges. She wants to basically understand any link between gallbladder issues and perimenopause. She also wants to know if there's an increased risk of developing gallstones from using hormone therapy, specifically estrogen. So let's first sort of break this down and take a look at exactly what the gallbladder is and what bile is. So whether or not these particular questions are relevant for you, this whole episode will still be really helpful to learn and understand what the gallbladder is, what bile is, and, you know, how we can support that, because we all do need to be supporting gallbladder health anyway, because it's how we essentially break down the fats in our diet, and we need to be able to break those down so that we can absorb nutrients from them and get, you know, the other good stuff that comes from eating good fats in the diet. So the gallbladder is a small pear-shaped sort of pouch-like organ located just up in the upper right part of your abdomen. So it's directly under the liver on the right-hand side. It plays a really important role in digestion, specifically of fats, but also it plays a really key role in the elimination of toxins from the body. So it's essentially part of the detoxification organs, as well as the liver and the gut. Its main job is to store and concentrate bile. Bile is a digestive fluid that's made in the liver. So the liver makes it first, sends it to the bile where it's stored and also then concentrated, and it will be released when it's needed. So that bile is made in the liver. It's essential for breaking down the dietary fats that we eat, but also for absorbing those really important fat-soluble vitamins, which are vitamin A, D, E, and K. Bile is a greenish-yellow fluid. It contains bile salts, also called bile acids. It contains phospholipids, so these are different types of fats, basically, cholesterol, processed bilirubin from the liver, and water. So that's essentially what this yellow-greenish fluid is, and that is what's sent to it flows from the liver into the gallbladder, where it's stored. And then when you eat a meal that's containing any fats, the gallbladder releases the stored bile through a series of ducts into the small intestine. And we will kind of call that bile flow from the gallbladder into the small intestine. And once it gets there, that bile helps to emulsify or break down those fats into smaller droplets that makes them easier for enzymes to digest and for the body to absorb and utilize. So for energy and absorption of those soluble fat-soluble vitamins I just mentioned. So gallbladder issues usually stem from problems with bile production. So that would be in the liver, bile flow, or bile, so flow from the liver into the gallbladder, or release from the gallbladder into the small intestine. So let's break this all down in more detail. And hopefully this will help Laura and anybody else identify where or why their bile gallbladder issues might be coming from. So bile production in the liver. So if there's problems with bile production, that's going to be a liver issue. The liver continuously produces bile. If the liver isn't producing enough, say due to sluggish liver function, having extra burdens on the liver, you know, potentially from daily environmental toxins or diet, lifestyle sort of contributing factors, then if there also so that any kind of liver disease or just simply even some nutritional deficiencies, for example, choline, all of the B vitamins, particularly B6, folate, B9, B12, these are really important, and taurine and some amino acids are really important for the liver to be able to do what it needs to do. So if there's any nutritional deficiencies in any of those things, then fat digestion can start to be impaired because the liver is not going to be able to make enough bile. Then we've got the issue of bile storage and release. So let's say the liver was able to make enough bile and send it to the gallbladder. The gallbladder is where it's stored, and it concentrates that bile between your meals. So when you eat a meal, one containing fat, the hormone cholecystokinin, also known as CCK, is released from the small intestine, and that signals to the gallbladder to contract and release bile. So it starts these little contractions that sort of then sort of gradually releases that bile down into the small intestine. If the gallbladder doesn't contract properly, say due to sluggish function, any inflammation, so this is in Laura's case, she has this inflammation in her gallbladder, or gallstones, but in her case there were no gallstones. So any of those issues, sluggish function of gallbladder, inflammation, gallstones, then the bile might not be released effectively. Even if enough is being made by the liver and sent into the gallbladder to be stored, the gallbladder just might not be able to contract and get it out. So that's then where impaired bile flow comes in. So this is also known medically as biliary dyskinesia or obstruction. So this is essentially a structural or sort of functional issue. And this is where the bile might not flow well into the small intestine due to gallstones blocking the bile ducts from the gallbladder into the small intestine. The bile might have become quite sludgy and thick, so it's just not flowing properly. And then there could be dysfunction in the biliary tract, or what's known as the sphincter of Oddi. So this will essentially cause pain, so this biliary colic, or poor fat breakdown, usually both, resulting in discomfort after eating fatty foods. Pale coloured or floating stools is usually a sign of not being able to break down your fatty foods, which would be caused by lack of bile. Diarrhea, nausea, so-called fish oil burps, deficiencies, of course, in fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E and K, which you wouldn't necessarily know unless you were specifically testing, like for vitamin D, for example. But, you know, essentially that discomfort after eating fatty foods, the pale coloured floating stools, the loose stools and nausea, those would be giveaway signs. So to support healthy fat breakdown and fat soluble nutrient absorption, it's obviously then important to focus on both the liver's production of bile. So the liver's ability to, you know, you want to take all the burdens off the liver that you can and allow your liver to do the work that it needs to do, which includes producing bile. And then we want to support the gallbladder's ability to release it effectively when needed. So that includes supporting the liver's production of bile, like I just said, the gallbladder motility, so those contractions can actually happen, and then the flow of the bile from the gallbladder down into the small intestine. So first I'll answer Laura's questions and then we'll sort of talk about some ways that you can support your liver and gallbladder. So she said, can her history of gallbladder issues impact her body's ability to break down and detoxify her estrogen, and therefore contribute to certain symptoms typical of perimenopause? And we can think of symptoms like, you know, when we're talking about issues breaking down and detoxifying estrogen, we're talking about the horrible PMS symptoms, including breast pain, headaches, potentially migraines, and then a very heavy, troublesome period when it does arrive. Those are your typical sort of high, you know, issues clearing out estrogen symptoms. So can a history of gallbladder issues impact her body's ability to break down estrogen? Yes, it can. Gallbladder issues can indirectly impact the liver's ability to detoxify, sort of break down that used estrogen once it gets there, and eliminate your estrogens effectively. Gallbladder issues don't stop the liver from detoxifying estrogens, but they can hinder that final step, which is getting them out of the body permanently via a bowel movement. You know, we need healthy gallbladder in order for all of these steps to work really well. So that can obviously over time contribute to this situation of estrogen dominance or unopposed estrogen. Even if somebody is making enough progesterone to oppose estrogen, if they're left with excess, that sort of used estrogen going back into the body and not leaving, then they have this estrogen dominant situation. So this is particularly relevant in perimenopause when estrogen levels are fluctuating wildly now. They can be really high, three times higher than ever before, let's say at least in the earlier stages of perimenopause, and even at 46 potentially. But either way, whether estrogen levels are low or high, they're fluctuating erratically. And so issues detoxifying our used estrogen can increase those symptoms that I've just mentioned, like the pre-menstrual mood swings, irritability, rage, breast pain or tenderness, heavy, painful periods, maybe with clots. So if you've listened to my previous episode or read my blogs where I've explained how the liver breaks down or metabolizes your estrogen, you might remember that this occurs in two phases. So phase one, you don't need to remember this at all, but this is known as hydroxylation for anyone that does want to know. In this phase, this phase changes those used estrogen molecules into various different metabolites known as breakdown products, using a set of enzymes called the cytochrome P450 enzymes. Again, you don't need to remember that, just trying to sort of set the stage. Then those breakdown products get moved into phase two. This is known as conjugation. This phase makes those estrogen metabolites water soluble, which makes them safer to then be removed from the body, because if they were just left in the form that they were in phase one, it's not a safe way for them to be excreted from the body. So phase two sort of packages them up. It uses specific processes called methylation, glucuronidation and sulfation so that they can be safely packaged into little boxes and then moved on to phase three, which is essentially the gut, where they can be excreted from the body permanently. So after that phase two, those conjugated estrogens, they're sent to the bile, basically, which is released into the small intestine and eventually eliminated in the stool. So you can see this is where the gallbladder's role in estrogen elimination comes in. If bile isn't flowing well from the gallbladder to the small intestine, those packaged up estrogens can build up and then eventually they get reabsorbed back into the liver and then back into circulation in the body, leading to excess estrogen, more unopposed and dominating estrogen, and more of those horrible symptoms we just spoke about. So even if the liver is doing its job at breaking down your used estrogen properly, stagnant bile can lead to this impaired elimination and impaired bile flow. And that can then result in the recirculation of that used estrogen, which none of us want. So her second question was, is there an increased risk of developing gallstones when using hormone therapy, so specifically estrogen? So whenever I would refer to any sort of hormone therapy, I'm always talking about body identical forms of estrogen and progesterone. So these would be the transdermal types, like gels, patches, for example. There is some evidence that shows a link between estrogen therapy and gallstones, in that estrogen increases the cholesterol content of bile, making it more likely to form gallstones, which are often cholesterol based. It can also reduce gallbladder motility, meaning that bile isn't released as efficiently, potentially increasing the risk of bile becoming stagnant and stones forming. But the research finds that oral estrogen therapy, particularly in higher doses, is more strongly associated with these things, the gallstone formation, compared to the body identical forms of estrogen, which is the transdermal stuff, the patch or the gel forms. So today's body identical form of estrogen therapy is usually transdermal, this body identical form, and that appears to bypass the liver to a greater extent than these sorts of synthetic oral forms, or even if it's body identical oral forms, and that then reduces the impact on bile composition and gallbladder risk. So if it's transdermal body identical, there's less risk associated. According to the research, of course, you would need to discuss this with your doctor and make sure that, you know, the risk is okay for you. So there are certain other risk factors that could increase the risk of gallstones, you know. So, of course, higher doses or long-term use of oral estrogen, which is more common in the older formulations and not used much today, in Europe. And I think in the USA as well, the body identical estradiol is more commonly used as hormone replacement therapy. But we've also got situations like being overweight or obese, living a sedentary lifestyle, diets high in ultra-processed foods and carbohydrates and trans fats and sugar, even moderate to high alcohol intake, but even just moderate levels of alcohol intake, particularly for women, can increase those risks. And a personal or family history of gallstones as well will increase those risks. So if we can work on things like, managing a healthy weight, living an active lifestyle, eating a diet that's rich in whole foods and plenty of, colourful vegetables and fiber and good quality proteins and good quality fats, of course, and plenty of hydration, then we can really support ourselves that way as well. So if a woman is at risk of gallstones or has a history of gallbladder issues, then the research says that transdermal estrogen is generally preferred, and using the lowest effective dose for symptom control is then probably the wiser option. But again, speak to your menopause doctor about this to see if it is right for you. I'm just sort of relaying what the research shows. Supporting bile production and bile flow. So again, like I said, through diet, hydration, movement, possibly herbs, which we'll look at in a moment, can be a helpful preventative measure alongside your hormone therapy, if this person chooses to go that route and her doctor says it's okay. So let's now have a look at how you can support your liver to detoxify properly and to therefore produce bile. And then we'll move on to how to support the actual bile flow from the gallbladder into the small intestine when it's needed. So nutrients that the liver needs to make bile include choline. So anything that I'm talking about nutrient-wise, they can, of course, be found in supplement form as long as you're looking at really high-quality brands. I've actually got a link in the show notes to a supplements dispensary website that I use and I refer my clients to, because they only stock very good quality brands. If anyone wants sort of examples of brands, you could look on there. But again, if we're talking about it through food, choline, for example, is found in eggs. That's in the egg yolk. Liver, so chicken liver, for example, it's found in soy lecithin, which you might find, you can sort of buy that in granule form. And of course, a choline supplement. Then we've got taurine. So this is an amino acid that's found in all animal products, any meat, fish, also taken as a supplement. Glycine, another important amino acid found in sort of collagen-rich foods like bone broth, collagen. B vitamins, so particularly B12, B6, and folate, also known as B9. That's really important for the liver's methylation and detoxification of estrogen and everything else as well. Vitamin C, zinc, and magnesium. So these are your really important nutrients that the liver needs to make bile and to detoxify. So for the liver to efficiently process toxins and maintain that healthy bile production, we need to support phase one and phase two liver detox pathways that I explained a moment ago. And foods that help to do this include cruciferous vegetables. So these things are so easy. Making sure you have a very frequent, if not daily, intake of the cruciferous vegetables, some of them, even just one or two of them a day. So broccoli, cauliflower, kale, cabbage, whether it's red, white, green, watercress, rocket, bok choy. The foundation of my vegetable supply is always broccoli, cauliflower, kale, cabbage. And then I add lots of different colours of veg on top of that. So the cruciferous vegetables contain glucosinolates that basically boost detox enzymes, the ones that we mentioned earlier. And then you've got sulfur-rich foods. So these are things like garlic, onions, eggs. These help to aid that phase two detox and bile, the conjugation of bile. Plenty of fiber. So plenty of fiber helps eliminate those bile-bound toxins in the stool and prevents that reabsorption. So really helping to prevent the reabsorption of that detox estrogen back into the body that I mentioned earlier that we really don't want. So plenty of fiber, you'd be looking at things like flaxseed, ground flaxseed, other nuts and seeds with the skin on. I love grinding things like flax, chia, pumpkin, sunflower, sesame seeds and putting them into smoothies or putting them over stir fries or salads. Really easy to do. And then plenty of sort of whole grains and starchy vegetables like, baby new potatoes with the skin on. What else am I thinking? Have a little bit of brain fog. Carrots, sweet potato, you know, your sort of starchy veg for your carbohydrate portion, or things like brown basmati rice, quinoa, buckwheat, beans, lentils, for example. Certain herbs and foods can support the liver and stimulate bile production. So these are bitter leaves like chicory, watercress, rocket, fennel, dandelion. Not really common to have dandelion in the supermarket these days, but definitely the others, chicory and watercress and rocket. Milk thistle, so we can get this in tincture form, very easily accessible from most like sort of health food shops. You would just put maybe 10 drops of milk thistle into a water or a herbal tea a couple of times a day. Artichoke leaf, you can also get that in tincture form. Dandelion root, you can get that in tincture form. Turmeric, ginger, beetroot, parsley. So I always get beetroot and just grate it. And then I'll just either put it in the food processor or I just quickly chop it up into really small pieces and just keep it in the fridge. And then I can throw it into salads and things. Sometimes I'll throw it into a smoothie. Parsley, you know, just use that in your salads, the fresh stuff, put it into your stir fry, soups, etc. But when it comes to using any of these kind of herbs like milk thistle, artichoke, dandelion, always check for any contraindications, especially if there's gallstones or bile duct obstruction suspected, you know, by your doctor, then just make sure that it's okay to use these things. And the following supplements can be helpful. So bile salts or ox bile. So you might see digestive enzymes that include ox bile. So that could be helpful because you'd have enzymes in there to help you break down things like proteins and carbohydrates. And it would have the ox bile in there to help break down fats. You can get something called TUDCA, which stands for taurursodeoxycholic acid. You don't need to remember that, but that's what TUDCA stands for. So the supplement itself is just called TUDCA, TUDCA. That's a very important bile acid that's been shown to support the liver and the gallbladder. NAC, N-acetylcysteine, phosphatidylcholine or choline. So we mentioned choline earlier in eggs and meat products. It's a great supplement as well. And glycine and taurine, of course, in supplement form. So bile is, but when I talk about supplements, though, it is really important that you are ideally working with somebody who really does know supplements and know how much you might need and which particular brands to go for. It's really easy to just walk into these cheaper high street shops and just find, oh, there's NAC or oh, there's some glycine. But they, you know, the cheaper they are, the less likely it is that they're made in a way that the body can absorb them properly. And they're potentially made with, there's lots of like added fillers, you know, and additives and things that just probably aren't very conducive to good liver health. So just be careful when it comes to supplements. So that, like I said, the link in my show notes is to a website that only deals with really very good, high quality brands. And it's a practitioner dispensary site. So you can have a look on there to get some examples. You can even use it to buy them. You just need to like mention me as your practitioner so that you can register. But it's a great website even just to look up some examples and see where you can find those particular brands. But of course, if you want one-to-one support, you want to work with somebody like me to get this sort of guidance, you can, of course, do that. So you'll find information about how to work with me on my website, or you can just drop me a message. So I digressed. So we were talking about supplements that can be helpful. Now, bile is produced and released in response to fat in the diet, remember? So it's not actually helpful to just avoid fats, though. That's not the answer. It's not treating the root cause of the problem. And it could just make things worse over time, particularly if you become deficient in those fat-soluble nutrients and all the other good stuff that we get from, you know, omega-6, omega-3, omega-9, all these different monounsaturated fats. We need all these different types of fats. We need to be eating cholesterol. So over time, that's not the long-term answer. So, you know, essentially we want to get to the point where we can eat moderate amounts of healthy fats like the olive oil, avocado, olives, oily fish, coconut oil. Over time, this actually encourages bile flow and production. But it's like, you know, it's hard at the time because you're trying to avoid symptoms. But these things also that you're told to avoid, they do actually help bile flow and production. So it's a hard one. But do try and avoid very low fat diets unless medically necessary, and ideally just temporarily while other things are being figured out and worked on. Staying hydrated, really important. This is such a simple thing that so many people miss. The amount of people I have coming into my practice who have, they actually have quite a good, you know, someone might have quite a good diet, but then we talk about their water intake and they're like, oh yeah, I just don't drink more than a couple of glasses. And it's so foundational. It's such a basic thing, but it's so, so important. So bile is a water-based fluid. So dehydration, and essentially dehydration is you know, if you're only drinking a couple of glasses of water a day, or you're not even getting up to near 2 liters, you could potentially be dehydrated. You don't just have to be thirsty in the Sahara Desert to be dehydrated. So that dehydration can make bile sluggish and concentrated, you know, too thick and too sludgy to actually get through. And that increases the risk of stones, gallstones. We want to avoid toxins that burden the liver. So this should be a no-brainer, but sometimes we just do need to be reminded alcohol is a massive, massive burden on the liver. It's not a popular piece of information, but particularly as we move past our, you know, from 40s upwards, even just one or two glasses here and there can be a real major burden on our liver. Ultra processed foods. So, you know, things like really processed sort of cereal bars, protein bars, your typical ultra processed foods that you'd find in the supermarket, like ready meals and cakes and things that have a sell by date of like 6 months, all these kind of things, refined sugar, environmental toxins. So the particular chemicals that we might find in certain cleaning products and plastics and pesticides and skincare products. I've talked about this before. I will do a future episode on these hormone disrupting chemicals, but all of these chemicals and things will just burden the liver. And so if we can take all of that burden off, that's a really, really great place to start anyway. So I hope this episode has been helpful. And for Laura specifically, I really hope this has been helpful in answering your questions. So do let me know. You emailed me this question, so drop me an email to let me know how you found this episode. Did I answer everything? And, you know, if you've got any other questions, of course, just put them in that email as well. So if there's anything you would like me to address on an upcoming episode personally, then please do reach out and just drop me a message. And if, of course, anyone wants to talk to me about working one-to-one with me, you can book a free discovery call via the link in the show notes, or you can just head to the homepage of my website, francescaliparotti.com, and there's a button there to book that discovery call. So thank you for listening, and I will see you next time. Bye-bye. If you found this episode helpful, then please share it with anyone else who you think could benefit. And consider leaving a rating and a review, as this will help the podcast to reach and help more people. And if you need more guidance on your own health journey, you can grab my free guide, 6 Steps to Mastering Your Hormones in Your 40s, over at francescaliparotti.com, where you can sign up for your free copy. Or you'll also find the link in the show notes.